Pushkin.
Hello, hello, revisionist history listeners. Malcolm Gladwell here. I know what you thought. You thought it was all over. You listened to episode 10 about all the cute doggies and thought to yourself, that's a wrap. How wrong you were, my friends. Because I'm back, baby, for one last special episode, a smorgasbord of behind-the-scenes moments, odd digressions, and sparkling bits of wonder from our last season. Now, before we get started, a few words about our subscription service, Pushnik, available via Apple Podcasts. Pushniks can listen to revisionist history and other great Pushkin shows without ads. But now, they'll also receive new bonus revisionist history episodes like the one you're about to hear. These episodes will appear exclusively in Pushnik feeds once a month through the end of the year. Pushnik is $4.99 a month, and you can try it free for a week. Subscribe to Pushnik on the Revisionist History show page in Apple Podcasts, and watch your feed for new delights. And if you're already a Pushnik, thank you. We hope you've enjoyed the uninterrupted listening and bonus content from other Pushkin shows. Now, on to today's installment. We're going to spend some time revisiting our massive, three-part blockbuster investigation of everything that was wrong with Disney's The Little Mermaid. First, let me take you back in time.
The people on the Zoom get like, Dax, can you guys still see us?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Everyone looks great.
Oh,
there you go.
That's what matters. Okay.
Okay, there we go.
Dax, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Here we were in the Magic Kingdom. Well, our Magic Kingdom, which isn't actually a kingdom, but whatever. The studios of Pushkin Industries. Mm. Me, Britt Marling. Jodie Foster, and Dax Shepard zooming in from Los Angeles, all together to record our new ending to The Little Mermaid, written by Britt in a burst of genius.
How are we doing? Do we do everyone's levels?
Yeah, we're rolling.
Dax sounds good.
Oh, let me hit record on my end.
That's what I was about to ask you.
Ooh, almost blundered. Almost floundered.
Ha!
Thank you.
That was a deep reference.
My daughter just played Flounder last week in this play, so that's the only reason it was on the tip of the tongue.
By the heat of Ariel's love, Ursula begins to transform back into her original form. Her slender limbs morph into thick barnacle-covered tentacles. Her wedding dress bursts open at the seams to reveal her sea-slick octopus body. A woman in the audience screams shrilly,
"Good God! Martine, you're up."
Disgusting. What is she?
Children cower under their seats. Grown men back away in horror. Eric stumbles and nearly falls over.
I almost married an octopus.
Just so you know, the response to our reimagining of The Little Mermaid was off the charts. We got mail, tweets, complaints, of course. There's always haters out there. But a few loyalists took their appreciation even further. A bunch of you signed a petition asking Disney to use our ending in the Little Mermaid reboot they have in the works. So Disney, if you're out there, and I know you are, it's not too late. DMs are open.
And now the sun finally sets. Ursula's old spell wears off. Ariel transforms into a mermaid once more. The guests have no reaction. At this point, they've really seen it all. Ariel laughs as her legs morph into a powerful fin. Eric drops down to her side.
Thank you for saving my life.
Ariel smiles at him.
Don't mention it.
All she really wanted was a thank you. It may be all any of us ever really want. Ariel turns to Ursula.
Shall we go home?
Ursula nods. They take each other's hands and jump.
Now, if you know me, you know I love to digress. In my exploration leading up to Britt Marling's brilliant rewrite, I took a few side paths. Most of those you heard in the Little Mermaid series, but there were a few that my editor, Julia, thought were too much. Julia's always holding me back. No, you can't say that, Malcolm. Well, Julia's on holiday right now, so you know what? I'm going to say that. Here we go. All the things Julia took out. I one point, I got really excited about a class analysis of Disney fairy tales. Here I am, getting all worked up. I mean, have you seen Beauty and the Beast? Don't even get me started.
Let us examine Disney's earliest animated feature fairy tale film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and one of the sort of latest Beauty and the Beast as examples.
This is Jack Zipes. In a lecture at Scripps College some years ago, he's the worldwide dean of fairy tale studies. I would encourage you, when this episode is over, to Google his talk, Zipes, Z-I-P-E-S, and his made-up word, de-Disneyfying. This is my favorite part.
Each film is framed by a prince on a quest for the proper mate, essentially a young virginal woman, a trophy princess who will serve his vested interests, and the quest ends with a marriage in a splendid castle in which the prince and princess will be attended by admiring, if not obsequious, servants.
Zipes can't get over how much of the plot of these movies is propelled by all those obsequious servants.
Their roles are all geared to guaranteeing the happiness of their heroes, seemingly born to lead, take power, and to be admired as fetish objects. The goal is not only a reconciliation of conflict and the defeat of evil, but also acclamation of those who deserve to rule by those who deserve to serve.
After I watched that lecture, I immediately called up Zipes. How could I not? He wasn't finished.
I mean, the Lion King, all the animals in the forest are to bow down to this one Lion King. Even Frozen, you know, which is supposedly a wonderful, jolly film. Why the hell should we care about these fucking princesses, you know, who are living a good life and above everybody else?
Well, exactly. Why should we care about these effing princesses who get nothing but good in return for being so good? If you're wondering, I still stand by that. I still don't care about those effing princesses. Okay, on to another digression. I do tend to fall in love with some of the people I interview at Revisionist History. I can't help it. This next bit, a tribute to one of them. The producers, well, Julia, said it went on a bit too long. They were, quote, starting to lose the thread, blah, blah, blah. As if we're a bunch of tailors at Revisionist History. Well, you be the judge. Little Mermaid, digression number two. I approached my first mentor, Angus Fletcher, because of a book he wrote called Wonderworks, the 25 Most Powerful Inventions in the History of Literature, which is this strange and captivating work full of twists and turns and fascinating asides. It's the kind of book that makes you want to talk to the author just to make sure there aren't more bits of wisdom out there to be had. In fact, I'm going to say right now that the odds of Angus Fletcher showing up again on Revisionist History one day are pretty close to 100%. I mean, just listen to this. A sentence chosen at random from one of the emails Angus Fletcher wrote me. If you ever want to do any more mad scientist story stuff, whether for content or just for curiosity, let me know! Exclamation point. Now, I'm a big believer in exclamation points. Whenever I see that bit of punctuation in another person's email, my heart surges with unbidden affection. Angus is an exclamation point guy. One time, when we were talking, I told him about how, as a child, I used to insist that my mother read to me the biblical story of Daniel in the lion's den. I make some remark, and he says,
You're just blowing my mind, and absolutely, and this is brilliant and amazing and true. The idea that Daniel will be in the lion's den, and that somehow a miracle could happen, and he could survive, and it's so improbable and so impossible, but it happened because it's on the page, and it's in history, and your mother is telling it to you.
They made me cut all that. Can you believe that? It's like they're conducting some kind of literary jihad against my true self. So I got excited about Angus Fletcher. You got a problem with that? Angus Fletcher is fantastic. So I'm taking the opportunity, dear listeners, to let you listen in on more of my conversation with the brilliant Dr. Angus Fletcher. The clips you've heard thus far don't even scratch the surface.
Your parents are Scottish.
That's actually right. My parents are Scottish. This is how I used to talk when I first came to this country. But and then the true story, I didn't have the money to pay for college because in America, as you might know, college is not something that the government pays for. So I had to join the United States Marine Corps, and the United States Marine Corps did not like me talking like this. So I had to actually develop this fake accent, which you hear now, in about one day in boot camp because I was just terrified out of my life and thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
And so I have this ridiculous fake American accent, which is the legacy of me being in the Marines. My ultimate background is in neuroscience. But, you know, as a child, I was just fascinated by stories and how they worked. And I, you know, had this sort of fortunate thing, which is that before I learned to read, my father would read me stories. And I think like any child, I was just completely flummoxed by the fact that this book, which contained these totally inert, you know, squiggles of ink, could somehow just pop my head with imagination, with feeling, and with just kind of most extraordinary things. And so just my whole life, I've always wanted to understand how they worked. And, you know, when I was working in the science lab, there was a kind of break or revolution, which is we started to realize that the human brain actually wasn't rational. For hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, we've wanted to think, well, the reason that humans took over this planet is because we're uniquely rational. And it turns out, what is the secret power? What is the superpower that humans have? It's narrative. It's the ability to link causes together, to establish sequences, to tell stories, you know, to say, if I do this, maybe this will happen, or maybe this is why that other thing happened. And so I basically left neuroscience and got an English PhD because I thought that if I studied in an English department, I would learn the secret of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And in all of these early stories, it's all about this chance happening, this random fairy, this magic fish, which just comes out of the ocean for no apparent reason at all and changes everything. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason for their effect on our brains, the specific hope effect they have on our brains. Well, then what happens at the end
Before you go on. I want to dig into that. That's a super interesting thing you just said, and I don't want to jump over it. When you say that's the reason for this specific effect they have on our brains, talk about that a little bit. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, so what they do is they activate our optimism. And to simplify things slightly, I don't want to make it seem as if the brain is quite as simple as the foregoing explanation is going to be, but to simplify things, the left side of our brain is more optimistic than the right side of our brain. And the reason for this is there's something called lateralization. So the two parts of our brain are slightly different, and they've evolved over time to have different functions. And this has led to a lot of myths about lateralization, most of which have been debunked. But what has been recently discovered is that the left side of our brain is more optimistic, and the right side is more cautious. And the reason for this evolutionarily is it allows for a balance in our head between a focus on what might go wrong and what might go right. And that balance is very healthy. You always want to have a little bit of caution, but you always want to have a little bit of optimism. And the classic fairy tales activate the left side of our brain, which is more closely connected to the parasympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. And that's responsible for calming us down. So if you ever get a kind of jolt and then your body relaxes, that relaxing is coming from your parasympathetic nervous system. And that's what the older fairy tales tap into. That's what they activated.
Now, why is it they activate that? So why is it that I tell you a story about how your life is transformed by some random arbitrary thing. Why does it zero in on that part of your brain?
Well, there's two reasons. First is it short circuits the other side of your brain. And the other side of your brain is the side of your brain that's gotten ramped up. That's the side that's already been activated by the sense of pessimism or despair. And we've all been in those situations. That's the source of stress in our lives. The moment something goes wrong in our lives, we immediately start to have a low-grade panic because that one thing makes our brain biologically think it's going to get worse. And that kind of panic response is responsible for keeping us safe. Our brains evolved in a very unstable environment where if one thing went wrong, it was good just to get out of there, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't want anything, you don't want to just wait around. And so the right side of our brain starts going panicking when things in our lives go wrong. So if you have a bad day, the right side of your brain is like, it's over for us. Mm-hmm. This is just terrible. We have to get out of town. We have to leave. It's a disaster. My life is over. And we've all had those moments where one bad thing happens and it just destroys our emotional mood. And that's called catastrophizing.
Yeah. Yeah. If we go back to the origins of these stories, what's our kind of model of how this happened? People weren't engineering these stories from the get-go because they knew they were uniquely powerful.
So there is this kind of feedback loop. Mm-hmm. But I think the other thing that's important is that human life did not start out being moral. Morality is something that was invented. And morality is the idea that good things lead to good things. And logic is invented. And logic is the idea that good people have good things happen to them. And so if you just go back to a state of nature, what people are interested in is not morality, but medicine. People are interested in, how do I solve problems? How do I reduce pain? How do I increase pleasure? And, you know, morality's answer to those questions is, oh, if you're a good person, then you'll be happy. But of course, that's not actually how things work in the real world. Biologically, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And so early on, when we were free of morality, when we were free essentially of the patriarchs telling us the Ten Commandments and the rest of it, nature could triumph. And nature's answer to how do you make a human brain feel better is to remind a human brain of the biological fact that good can come from bad, that luck exists, at least from the perspective of the human brain, because the human brain, you know, can't quantify the reasons that everything happens. And just hang on there, hold on. Mm-hmm. And you're much more likely to succeed in life if you are an optimist. And so the more that our brain is optimistic, the more our brain thrives and the more that people around us thrive. And so optimism is just a kind of evolutionary benefit.
Yeah.
And so you can kind of see why these stories won out in the absence of morality, which is an artificial system imposed, you know, largely by the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And the reality is that storytelling should be an experiment. It should be messy. It should allow for mistakes. And audiences are actually very forgiving of mistakes and what you might think of as being bad stories. Mm-hmm. Because really what audiences are most interested in is a story that takes them somewhere new, is a story that takes a chance, is a story that is brave. And audiences will follow that kind of story anywhere.
Have you gone to Disney and made this argument about these sort of traditional Disney fairy tale movies?
Well, so this is interesting. I mean, one of the things that I do is I consult for a lot of the studios on how to fix stories and whatnot. And my view of the matter is that Disney destroyed Pixar, because Pixar had this amazing method that it had learned from Steve Jobs, which allowed for story innovation. And Disney did the opposite. Disney had this idea that basically every story has to follow our Disney formula. And so they essentially brought in Pixar and destroyed Pixar by turning it into a Disney machine. And Disney has done this over and over and over again. They take innovative, interesting, groundbreaking stories and they recycle them endlessly until they're burnt out. It's not just that I think that Disney has sent a lot of fairy tales in the world, which have overall made us less happy. I think it's also that they are a force against innovation and change and growth in storytelling as a whole. And they are destroying our capacity as a people to think of new directions and new paths and new plots. So I think that they are the greatest menace. I mean, if you believe as I do that story is the most important thing in the world, then the reason I believe that, people often say, oh, that's so odd. But story is the beginning of everything. Story is the beginning of a new political movements. Story is the beginning of new businesses, new technologies, new cultural movements. You have to tell a story and you have to make people believe in that story. You have to make them care about that story.
One last question. I would like you to give me your recommendation of what you think is the best children's movie and what you think is the worst of all Disney movies. If there's one that a child should never watch, what is it? And if there's one they absolutely should watch.
Up is my favorite. Up is the best. And you know, I'll be honest. I mean, we live in a world where we keep being told that culture can be toxic and people keep freaking out about, you know, the books that we give people. Books are never really that bad. I mean, you know, it's like food. Food is really never that bad. A candy bar is not going to really hurt you. A Disney movie is not going to really hurt you. These aren't bad. It's just that you don't want to always eat chocolate and you don't want to basically have, you know, the chocolate being mass produced by this company that can then endlessly advertise the chocolate while you're not eating anything else. So I don't worry. I don't think people should worry or get anxious about quote unquote bad stories. It's really just a bigger problem that you just want to have variety in your diet. Mm-hmm. And you want to encourage kids in general to experience that, just like you want to encourage them to experience new kinds of food. So I would never say this is a story that every kid must read or this is a terrible story. I would just say variety, balance, growth, opportunity, empower your kids to tell you the kinds of stories they like, and keep suggesting new ones to them because that's how they grow.
Yeah, yeah. Lovely. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so much, Malcolm.
Okay,
back to the Pushkin Studios one last time. On our incredible day of recording Rip Marling's revised ending for The Little Mermaid. This all came together very quickly, by the way. No agents, no NDAs, no Hollywood deals, just people willing to follow their desire to free Ariel and her underworld universe from a really bad plot. Next thing I know, I'm taking direction from Rip Marling, and Jodie Foster is just sitting there, judging me.
So are you ready to do your part?
Oh, the priest. The priest. The vicar. I wonder why you guys were all waiting. Wait, can I have a script? I'm like, we're going to swap me out. I can't compete with all of these.
Come on,
people, it's like
Malcolm.
A Hitchcock moment. People are waiting for it, for your voice.
All right. Now, okay, give me some direction.
Be your...
Who is the priest? Britt, tell me who the priest is so I can... I'm going to try and be a real actor.
You are a real actor.
I mean, am I sort of sententious and...
I think it's like you're there doing the like official, you know, bidding, and then this thing gets interrupted. You know, you ever seen, do you remember the priest from The Princess Bride?
Oh, and I don't.
Don't tell me you haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it.
Like, this is a classic.
I never TV. I never TV.
Right.
All right. Well, I'll do my best here.
Classic officiousness that's going to get interrupted
to
by all these shenanigans.
Okay.
Priestly arms. All
right, let me do a version. Do you, Prince Eric, take Ursula to have and to hold in sickness and in health for as long as you both shall live? Actually, it's a question, right? Do you, Prince Eric, take Ursula?
All right. I did okay. I tried. But maybe from here on out, I'll leave the acting to the professionals. There's one last moment we couldn't find a place for in the podcast series, but I wanted you to hear it because, of course, I'm not the first person to think of revising The Little Mermaid. Many other greats have come before me and the Pushkin players, and foremost among those, the Broadway performer, Cynthia Nesbitt. As you might remember, the original Hans Christian Andersen version of The Little Mermaid was almost certainly an allegory for unrequited gay longing. So what you're about to hear isn't idle mischief. Cynthia Nesbitt decided to set the historical record straight. Actually, she decided to unstraighten the historical record, which will make sense in a moment. Here she is, recorded live at Birdland in New York City a few years ago at a Queering the Stage event.
Look at those girls. Aren't they sweet? They look like they're really in love, don't you think? Making out like that out in the open. Wow, I guess times have changed. So, I came out back in 2011. I was a sophomore, and everybody who knew me back then knew that I loved two things, mashed potatoes and The Little Mermaid. Now, both of them were there for me back at a time when nobody knew I liked girls. But only one of them is, you know, relevant for this song. So I'm vice president of the Straight Allies Association. I've gone to Pride every year since sixth grade. Tegan and Sarah posters? I got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more. I want to be where the lesbians are. I want to see them dancing, walking around in those, what do you call them? Doc Martens. Boys who date me never get too far. I bet that they called it like way before I did. And every guy that I've liked has really long hair. I think I like girls. I think that I'm gay. I think that it's time to come out finally. Let everyone see. I want to be part of that world. What would
part
I be
of that world?
Thank you.
thank you, listeners, for joining our world. Subscribe to Pushnik in Apple Podcasts to get more of these monthly bonus episodes, full of expanded interviews, outtakes, and behind-the-scenes glimpses into how we make revisionist history. It's easy to subscribe from the show page in Apple Podcasts. Thank you, thank you, thank you, and see you soon. Revisionist History is produced by Mia LaBelle, Lee Mengistu, and Jacob Smith, with Eloise Linton and Ananai. Our editor is Julia Barton. Original scoring by Luis Guerra, mastering by Flan Williams, and engineering by Martin Gonzalez. Fact-checking by Amy Gaines. Special thanks to the Pushkin crew, Hedda Fain, Carly Migliori, Maya Koenig, Maggie Taylor, Eric Sandler, Nicole Morano, Jason Gambrell, and of course, Jacob Weisberg. I'm Malcolm Gladwell.